When Iraq held parliamentary elections on March 7th, the world watched closely because it was felt that they would be an indication of just how far Iraq had come since the fall of Saddam Hussein. That was 2 months ago, and there's still been no official result. Joining me now to discuss the disputed elections and what's being done to prepare for the departure of American troops is Quil Lawrence, NPR's Baghdad bureau chief. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hi, Quil.
Hi there.
Last month, an Iraqi court ordered a recount of ballots in Baghdad, a major victory for Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Had al-Maliki fared worse than he'd expected in the elections?
Yes, he thought he was going to do much better, and mostly he just couldn't believe that Ayad Alawi, who's a former prime minister and a secular Shiite who has the support of almost all of the country's Sunnis, Maliki, the sitting prime minister, could not believe that Alawi had beat him out. And he only beat him out by two seats. It's a parliamentary system, not a presidential one. So the winner of the largest bloc just had the first chance to try forming a government. The margin between them was only two seats, and really this when the government is formed in Iraq, the coalition is going to be a margin of 20 or 40 seats ahead of the opposition.
So why just the ballots in Baghdad? Weren't there other areas where voting irregularities were reported?
Well, this is the thing. Maliki had requested five different provinces be recounted. And there was a curious thing that happened over the couple of weeks between the vote and the official announcement of the results. About every side went on the record as claiming that it was fraud and that we have evidence of irregularities. So it was kind of hard for them as the preliminary results said, oh, Maliki's in the lead. Well, Maliki quieted down about his charges of fraud. And then when an Alawi would pipe up and say, no, this isn't right, when Alawi turned out to be ahead, well, Alawi seemed to misplace all of his evidence of fraud, and Maliki started demanding a recount. And in the latest twist, which I'm sure you're going to ask about, I hope I'm not preempting your question.
No, it's okay. You can answer it, and then I won't have to ask the question.
Is that the two major Shiite religious blocs, one of which is Prime Minister Maliki's bloc, have just announced that they're joining. So all of the fuss about the recount, which Maliki was pushing for, is pretty irrelevant now because he now has probably the largest bloc again. They've decided to make a coalition, and going into parliament, they'll be the largest bloc. They'll have the first chance to try forming a government. And now I imagine a lot of people must be wondering, why did we do this? Why did we start this recount process? It's going to take a couple, 3 weeks, and now we have to go through with it.
Well, another interesting irony here is al-Maliki called the court's decision evidence of the independence of the judiciary. And then the recount started on Monday, and he raised objections within hours to the way that it was being carried out.
Yeah, one view of Maliki's behavior and his actions since the vote have been that, well, he's a politician. He just narrowly lost an election, although, again, he still got a chance to command the largest bloc. But at the time, it seemed like, okay, he's narrowly lost. He's going to fight through every legal measure he can to try and win, just like people do in politics. They fight really hard. Hopefully they stay within the rule of law. Now, that was the question, though. Was Maliki influencing the courts? Is he powerful enough so that the Supreme Court, when it was making decisions, two major ones which were ruled in his favor, was he pressuring them? Were they afraid of ruling against him? And furthermore, was he making statements that hinted at violence, sectarian violence? At some point he said, what boils down to, I'm still the commander-in-chief and everyone better do the right thing. Well, that raised a lot of red flags, and his opponents were charging that he was threatening some sort of a coup. Now, there have been charges and countercharges saying the same thing.
Didn't you recently interview Ayad Alawi, the secular Shiite leader?
Sure. Just before I left Iraq. I've just finished up a year's posting there.
What's he saying about all of this?
Well, at the time, he said he wasn't going to honor the recount. He might reject the recount results. And we'll still have to see what happens with this. He's in the strange position of being a secularist. He's a Shiite, but he's essentially won almost universal Sunni support. So he's representing the Sunnis. For many of his opponents, suddenly he's representing the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, the past. But we haven't heard too much noise from him about some of the moves that Maliki has made. He certainly hasn't invoked some of Iraq's worst specters of sectarian violence, but the Sunnis feeling alienated is something that American and Iraqi observers have been worried about for a long time. It's having one major group like that feeling alienated could undo all of Iraq's progress, and it's a group that still has something of a groundwork for what they called resistance, what others called insurgency. It still has the sympathy of many Sunni Gulf Arab states who might be willing to join their protest, let's say, against a Shiite-dominated government.
Well, the Sunnis turned to Alawi after the decision to exclude hundreds of Sunni candidates from the ballots in the first place became a problem. They might have voted for somebody else, and now it seems like they've been totally excluded, even though the Sunnis do make up a large minority in the country. You're suggesting that what might happen again is that groups like Sunni Awakening, which had been working with U.S. forces to fight insurgents, now are losing power, and they might very well move back to where they were before they decided to cooperate.
Yeah, that's sort of a worst-case scenario, and I mean, it's something that people need to bear in mind. I don't know if it's something to be alarmed about, but maybe something to be prepared for. These Sunni Awakening Councils, who used to be fighting with the insurgency against the Americans, but over the years turned against al-Qaeda in their communities because these outside groups were causing so many civilian deaths. And they eventually ended up helping the Americans more or less evict al-Qaeda from Anbar and other places. They've been deactivated and co-opted to a large degree. But in the long term, yes, the Sunnis are a huge minority in Iraq, and cutting them out of power completely would seem to be an unhealthy idea for the country.
The recount won't be completed for 2 weeks, and as you say, it's unlikely anyone will accept the results. How closely have Iraqis been following all of the ins and outs of this government formation process?
They're definitely paying close attention. They're kind of two sides to it. On the one hand, they're following every twist and turn, every conspiracy theory and rumor that gets reported in the local tabloid media, all of the plots, and that the Americans have been behind this or the Iranians have been behind that. On the other hand, they seem simultaneously kind of, I guess, armored with sort of a resignation. They seem to be, a common response when I would say, well, look, it looks like the Shiites are going to, you know, if I was in Fallujah, a Sunni-dominated town, and I'd say, what are you going to do? It looks like the Shiites are going to dominate the next government. People would say, well, what did you expect? We knew it. We knew it was going to be stolen by Iran in any case. And on the other side as well, you know, well, what do you think about the fact that Alawi won and so many of these Sunnis might be getting into the government? And Shiites would say, well, of course it was the Americans who made this happen. There's sort of a resignation to what might come, which I suppose is not preferable, but a little bit better than someone vowing to say, no, we're going to overthrow this government. We're going to go back to fighting.
But it's interesting that people are either saying that it's an Iranian or an American victory. They're not seeing it as an Iraqi victory in either case.
Yes, Iraq has been, a country where the neighbors have never been without some influence. And I think, though, I mean, on a more encouraging note, on Election Day, a lot of people came out to vote. And I've covered, I guess, four of the five major votes or referendums they've had. And they're always great days to be out in Iraq because people really do come out. In this last election morning, as you recall, there were a lot of bombs going off. Most of them turned out to be low-power noisemakers that didn't hurt anyone. There were dozens of people killed, but it was still not as bad as it sounded. I was up on the roof of the NPR Baghdad Bureau counting, I think, something like 30 explosions inside 40 minutes. And I got quite intimidated. I stayed in an extra hour before I went out to report. But the people I was talking to, I asked them, were you scared to come out to vote today? with all these bombs going off, and they said, no, I came out because of the bombs. There was a real defiance, and there were people who were voting for, the people who voted for Alawi were saying, yes, we as Sunnis have a chance now, or we as secular Iraqis have a chance to have a less sectarian government. People were voting for al-Maliki really because they felt like he had given the country back its sovereignty and some of its pride, and also in taking on some of the sectarian militias from his own sect, from the Shia sect, that he had brought some measure of stability back to the country.
Well, Sunnis had boycotted the previous election. Did they feel that they had learned a lesson from that?
Yes, I think it became pretty clear, and that's another optimistic note, really, is that the game in Iraq has been politics. The Sunnis boycotted the drafting of the Constitution, and then they had very little Sunni input into the Constitution, and then during the referendum, they just squeaked by voting for it, and they were cajoled and coerced in many ways into voting for it in some areas. And then they saw that this constitution, however flawed, was the law of the land, and it was really the new playing field for Iraqi disputes. There's still a lot of people solving problems violently there, but there are a lot of people who are following the different different fine print in the constitution and the election law. That's really what's been holding up all of this. The results and the government formation is being held up because people are following the letter of the law. You mentioned these disqualifications of Sunni candidates in the last election. That, for better or for worse, was part of the law. So I suppose, despite the delay, you could be encouraged by the fact that Iraqis are following this framework, even if it is taking them so long.
I'm talking with Quil Lawrence, Baghdad Bureau Chief for NPR. Can't this new alliance, this government formed by Nouri al-Maliki's State of Law Coalition and the Iraqi National Alliance led by Ibrahim al-Jafari, be seen as a victory for Iran, because both have been, at least rumors, have linked them to Iran?
Yes. Well, some of these guys were in exile in Iran during Saddam. I'd say that the most extreme examples are members of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution. One of the groups that was hosted in Iran and during the Iran-Iraq War was actually trained up and fought against Iraq. It's too much of a generalization to say everyone in these alliances is an Iranian stooge. Iran is going to be a hugely powerful influence on Iraq no matter what. 60% of Iraq, roughly, is Shiite, and Iran is the Shiite power in the region. They're going to be connected. It remains to be seen whether this is somehow the defined rise of Iran. We'll have to see who the compromise candidate is. If these two groups have come together, and this has just happened in the last 24, 48 hours, if these two groups come together to form a government, they are probably not going to be able to push through Maliki as their prime minister, because many members of this list do not like Maliki, and he, especially the Sadrist, Muqtada al-Sadr's followers, are still very angry with Maliki. So we'll see who their candidate is and whether this is someone who spent a lot of time in Iran or whether it's someone like, for example, Nouri al-Maliki, who is not seen as really so much of an Iranian creation.
The Kurds have about 20 to 25% of the seats in parliament, and they got more in this election. Are they the swing vote for forming a coalition? Since Kurdish politicians are known for closing ranks on the big issues, does that make them a much more powerful minority than they might be otherwise?
They were very powerful in the previous elections, where Sunnis boycotted and Kurds became really the kingmakers. I don't think any of these blocs thinks that they can make a government without the Kurds, because the Kurds are in a semi-autonomous region in the north that is more or less self-sustaining, and to exclude the Kurds is really to invite them to draw further back and towards independence. Now, an independent state up there isn't viable at the moment, but they could cut off more, and if the Arab governments shut them out, then they would almost be more justified in doing so. At the same time, their influence is less than the last election. There are Sunnis in there, the Kurds, so therefore got a less of a proportion in the government. And they also have some interesting internal divisions, some would say growth of opposition parties up there, which makes the Kurdish political system a bit more competitive, and that actually cost them a bunch of seats in this election. So they are slightly less powerful, but they're still going to have to be included, and they'll drive a hard bargain on things like the city of Kirkuk, which is disputed. They would like to have it as part of their autonomous region, on things like oil revenue sharing and oil exploration rights.
Well, we have less than a minute, but there are plans to pull out 45,000 American troops from Iraq by the end of August. I'm wondering whether the unresolved election has thrown those plans into limbo, and how Iraqis feel about the departure of the troops. Does it depend on whether they're Shia, Sunni, or Kurds?
Yes, definitely. There are different people have different opinions. The Sunnis might feel like the Americans are the only thing protecting them from Iran at this point. I've heard people say that. The Kurds also feel like the Americans have really been the guarantors of minority rights, their rights in the new Iraq. But by all appearances, there is no change in course. The drawdown, which is an Obama administration decision, it's not part of the Status Forces Agreement. They're going to draw down to 50,000 troops by September 1st, and I think that train is already really rolling out of the station. It's such a massive logistical effort that it'd be very hard to turn around right now. And since the U.S. troops left Iraqi cities last June, they've been much less visible, and I think Iraqis are starting to think maybe we can get along without them. We'll have to see if
Quill,
that's the case.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Quill Lawrence is NPR's Baghdad bureau chief, and we've been talking about the still turbulent situation in Iraq.